Impersonating Jed McKenna. But with the clear certitude of the self's disappearance, there automatically arose the question of what had fallen away. What was the self? What exactly had it been? Then, too, there was the all-important question. What remained in its absence? Bernadette Roberts. No man is a prophet in his own country. That line keeps running through my mind as I sit over lunch with my sister, who I haven't seen in several years. These days, I'm the enlightened guy, but to her, I'm just the bratty kid who couldn't make eye contact when she wore a bikini. It's summer 01, and we're having lunch in Lower Manhattan. She read a preview copy of Damnedest and has had a few months to digest it. It was very nice of her to read it, because it's really not her kind of thing. She's a good citizen, a successful executive, wife, mother, Republican, tennis nut, Christian-ish, and all-round productive member of society. She once told me she was raising her children to be productive members of society, and I winced so hard I almost chipped a tooth. She's a wonderful person, but not a member of the demographic the book speaks to. There's a plate of chilled pasta in front of me, and a salad in front of her. We're both drinking iced tea. She runs the creative side of a medium-sized ad agency, and, I have no doubt, she's very good at it. She's taking time out of her very hectic schedule to have lunch with me. After this, I'm going to the park to lay in the grass and watch people play with their dogs. Visiting your sister and having lunch shouldn't be a confusing ordeal, but it is. Is she really my sister? What does that mean? We share some history and acquaintances, such as childhood and parents. Are my parents really my parents? Genetically, they are related to my body, but the person who lived my childhood is no longer here. The past I share with this person is about as real and important to me as if I'd read it in a brochure. The problem is that these people, my family, are all related to my shell, and I'm not. They're looking at the outer Jed McKenna and assuming an inner Jed McKenna. I'm inside Jed McKenna, looking out, and I can't really remember what he's supposed to do or say. It's all fakery. I'm an actor playing a role for which I feel no connection and have no motivation. There cannot be anything genuine in my dealings with people who are dealing with my outer garment. The whole thing is further entangled by the fact that there's no I inhabiting my shell, just a fading echo. But let's not go down that road just now. Actually, it's not really confusing. I possess not the least shred of doubt about who and what I am. The tricky thing is that who and what I am is not related to this pretty, professional, salad-eating woman across from me. By coming to this lunch, I have inserted myself into a situation where I do not belong. I am an imposter. I have some residual fondness for my sister, and if she died, I'd be saddened to think that she was no longer in the world. But the simple fact is that our former relationship no longer exists. Okay, so why am I telling you this? Because that's what I do. I try to hold this enlightenment thing up for display, and this seems like an interesting aspect of the whole deal. How do you relate to the people who were most important to you before awakening from the dream of the segregated self? She asks why I'm in town. My astrologers told me it was a good time to get away and not try to accomplish anything. They said that Ketu and Rahu wouldn't be letting me get anything done for a while anyway. I look up and see that she has stopped chewing in mid-mouthful and is staring at me incredulously. What? My astrologers. You're not serious. You have astrologers? Oh, yeah, I guess that sounds weird. I was vaguely aware that I was trying to be funny by starting a sentence with, "My astrologers told me." But what's a little amusing to me is otherworldly to her. Might as well have fun with it. I have dozens of astrologers. I can't swing a dead cat without hitting someone who's doing my chart or explaining how my future will unfold, advising me on pretty much everything. Her expression doesn't change. You have astrologers? Lots. Gotta beat them off with a stick. And they tell you what the future holds? What you should do? When you should do it? What you should avoid? Is that what we're talking about? I suppose. She resumes chewing, but the wide-eyed gaze remains. There's a chasm in this conversation across which there's no point trying to communicate. She knows I'm into some serious weirdness, but not how much or what kind. I don't really have astrologers, of course. But in those days, it did seem like I was surrounded by students of Eastern and Western astrology who were always very eager to share their readings. Well, what do you do with all that information? Me? Nothing. I mean, I don't ask for it. It's not like I wake up and summon the court astrologers to plan my day. It sounds like you do. I was speaking lightly. I'm trying to skip playfully along the surface of this conversation. I don't want to sink down into the kind of answer I'd give a serious student. The truth is that I don't possess any mechanism that would allow me to be curious or concerned about the future, but saying that doesn't make for breezy conversation. Jesus, she says, shaking her head. My little brother has his own astrologers. Well, they're not really mine. They're just in attendance, so to speak. I'm used to conversing with people who aren't awake and aren't happy about it. Everything else is chit-chat, talking for the sake of talking, reinforcing the illusion of self. I'm not against it. I just don't care to participate in it. So, you obviously have a great deal of influence over your students, she says as she sips her iced tea. I mull her statement over and decide that I don't have a response. I take another bite of pasta, wishing I'd ordered something with meat. I mean, she says, they obviously hold you in very high regard. That's quite a responsibility. She thinks, quite understandably, that she's my big sister and we're having a nice little catch-up lunch. She's been thrown a curve with this little brother spiritual master thing, and she's trying to handle it. Does she think I'm a fraud? Does she think I'm running a game? Does she think that underneath it all I'm still really her little brother? I don't know, and I don't much care. The fact that she's read Damnedest doesn't mean that she and I can speak. It means she should know we can't. She doesn't seem to be clear on that. Maybe she thinks the Enlightenment thing is just my day job and that I can step out of that role to be with someone who knows the real me. I don't know. I suppose it's a responsibility. You don't know. Obviously, these people are strongly influenced by you. You don't think that's a big responsibility? I shrug. The first thing she said to me when we got together was that I wasn't dressed well enough for the restaurant. Such a statement is so alien to me that I could only shrug. Now it seems that every statement she makes is so alien to me that I can only shrug. In accepting this lunch engagement, my hope was that I could slip back into my old persona enough to manage a civil meal. That was too hopeful. I can no longer impersonate myself, and I am simply unable to formulate a reply to anything she has to say. I've forgotten my lines. We don't share a common tongue, and there's no way I can make her see that. From her point of view, she's saying perfectly normal, conversational things. "Yes, I suppose it's a big responsibility," I say, trying to say something that sounds like I'm saying something. She lowers her voice. "You hear a lot about people in your position taking advantage of that responsibility for," she lowers her voice, "unsavory purposes. I know you would never do something like that." I could simply tell her what the preview copy of the book was meant to tell her, that we are no longer related because what I am now doesn't relate. But why say it? To satisfy myself? It wouldn't. To inform her? It wouldn't. "You mean sex stuff? That sort of thing?" "Whatever. Power corrupts. I just hope you'll be careful." Sweet. Big sister giving little brother some advice on how to shoulder the burden of power. Being in advertising, perhaps she thinks we have something in common, wielding the power to influence people's thoughts. Maybe she thinks we're in the same business. I don't know. I set down my fork and sit back. Well, when I walk through the house, I always have someone precede me with a boombox playing Darth Vader theme music to lend a weighty and ominous air to my approach. And I certainly don't dress like this. I have, you know, the robes, the beads, and I always carry fresh flowers. Just trappings. All very tiresome, really, but the underlings expect it. There was a little resistance at first to having them call me Shri Jed, but they got the hang of it. And remembering to speak in the first person plural there and singular here can take a little getting used to. But we are, I am happy to make the effort. Noblesse oblige and all. She stares at me for a long moment, then bursts into laughter. I guess some ice has broken because we are able to continue in a lighter and friendlier manner, and eventually say goodbye with genuine fondness. I doubt I'll ever see her again, but I'm happy knowing she's still in the world. Blues for Buddha. Whether there be prophecies, they shall fail. Whether there be tongues, they shall cease. Whether there be knowledge, it shall vanish away. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part. But when that which is perfect is come, then that which is in part shall be done away. When I was a child, I spake as a child. I understood as a child. I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. 1 Corinthians 13. Being critical of Buddhism isn't easy. Buddhism is the most likable of the major religions, and Buddhists are the perennial good guys of modern spirituality. Beautiful traditions, lovely architecture, inspiring statuary, ancient history, the Dalai Lama. What's not to like? Everything about Buddhism is just so Nice. No fatwas or jihads. No inquisitions or crusades. No terrorists or pederasts. Just nice people being nice. In fact, Buddhism means niceness. Nice-ism. At least, it should. Buddha means awakened one. So Buddhism can be taken to mean awake-ism. Awake-ism. It would therefore be natural to think that if you were looking to wake up, then Buddhism, i.e. awake-ism, would be the place to look. The light is better over here. Such thinking, however, would reveal a dangerous lack of respect for the opposition. Maya, goddess of delusion, has been doing her job with supreme mastery since the first spark of self-awareness flickered in some monkey's brain box. And the idea that the neophyte truth-seeker can just sign up with the Buddhists, read some books, embrace some new concepts, and slam her to the mat would be a bit on the naive side. As billions of sincere but unsuccessful seekers over the last 25 centuries might grudgingly attest. On the other hand, why not? How'd this get so turned around? It's just truth. Shouldn't truth be, like, the simplest thing? Shouldn't someone who wants to find something as ubiquitous and unchanging as truth be able to do so? How can anyone manage to not find truth? And here's this venerable organization supposedly dedicated to just that very thing, even named for it. And it's a total flop. So what's the problem? Why doesn't Buddhism produce Buddhas? The problem arises from the fact that Buddhists, like everyone else, insist on reconciling the irreconcilable. They don't just want to awaken to the true. They also want to make sense of the untrue. They want to have their cake and eat it too. So they end up with nonsensical theories, divergent schools, sagacious double talk, and zero Buddhas. Typical of their insistence on reconciling the irreconcilable is the Buddhist concept of two truths, a poignant two-word joke they don't seem to get. And yet this sort of perversely irrational thinking is near the very heart of the failed search for truth. We don't want truth. We want a particular truth, one that doesn't threaten ego, one that doesn't exist. We insist on a truth that makes sense given what we know, not knowing that we know nothing. Nothing about Buddhism is more revealing than the Four Noble Truths, which, not being true, are of dubious nobility. They form the basis of Buddhism. So it's clear from the onset that the Buddhists have whipped up a proprietary version of truth shaped more by market forces than any particular concern for the less consumer-friendly, albeit true, truth. Buddhism may be spiritually filling, even nourishing, but insofar as truth is concerned, it's just the same old junk food in a different package. You can eat it every day of your life and die exactly as awakened as the day you signed up. Bait and switch. Buddhism is a classic bait and switch operation. We're attracted by the enlightenment in the window, but as soon as we're in the door, they start steering us over to the compassion aisle. Buddhists could be honest and change their name to compassionism. But who wants that? There's the rub. They can't get us in the door with compassion, and they can't deliver on the promise of enlightenment. It's not limited to compassion, of course. Their shelves are stocked with all sorts of goodies and enticements. Practically anything anyone could ever want, with just the one rather notable exception. If they had just stopped when they had the anicca, impermanence, and anatta, no self, then they would have had a true and effective teaching they could be proud of. Except there would be no they, because Buddhism would have died with the Buddha. They'd have a good product, but no customers. This untruth in advertising is the kind of game you have to play if you want to stay successful in a business where the customer is always wrong. You can either go out of business honestly or thrive by giving the people what they want. What they say they want and what they really want, though, are two very different things. Me, me, me. To the outside observer, much of Buddhist knowledge and practice seems focused on spiritual self-improvement. This, too, is hard to speak against, except within the context of awakening from delusion. Then it's easy. There is no such thing as true self. So any pursuit geared toward its aggrandizement, betterment, upliftment, elevation, evolution, glorification, salvation, etc., is utter folly. How much more so any endeavor undertaken merely to increase one's own happiness or contentment, or, I'm embarrassed just to say it, bliss. Self is ego, and ego resides exclusively in the dream state. If you want to break free of the dream state, you must break free of self, not stroke it to make it purr or groom it for some imagined brighter future. Maya's House of Enlightenment. The trick with being critical of so esteemed and beloved an institution is not to get dragged down into the morass of details and debate. It's very simple. If Buddhism is about awakening, people should be waking up. If it's not about awakening, they should change the name. Of course, Buddhism isn't completely unique in resorting to shoddy marketing tactics. This same gulf between promise and performance is found in all systems of human spirituality. We're looking at it in Buddhism because that's where it's most pronounced. No disrespect to the Buddha is intended. If there was a Buddha and he was enlightened, then it's Buddhism that insults his memory, not healthy skepticism. Blame the naked emperor's retinue of lackeys and lickspittles, not the unbeguiled lad who merely states the obvious. Buddhism is arguably the most elevated of man's great belief systems. If you want to enjoy the many valuable benefits it has to offer, then I wouldn't presume to utter a syllable against it. But if you want to escape from the clutches of Maya, then I suggest you take a closer look at the serene face on all those golden statues and see if it isn't really hers. Collision with the planet? So it appears. From space, the planet might look like God, or truth, or true self, something like that, depending on the eye of the beholder. But the destination is always the same. The one source, the gravity well that reaches out from the center of the planet and pulls us all in. Prior to the first step, one maintains a gradually accelerating slow approach orbit. After the first step, one shoots like a missile straight at the planet's center, heedless of consequences, only to discover at the moment of impact that there's really no planet, no gravity, no self, no nothing. No one can explain this in a way that makes any sense. So the answer I give when asked is, come see for yourself. Break out of orbit. Don't worry about getting to the planet. A decaying orbit will get you there sooner or later. Everyone wants to wake up by hastening or altering their orbit. And, as the results clearly indicate, it doesn't seem to make any difference. There's only one way. You have to break out of orbit. That's the first step, and that must be the goal of the person in orbit, not spiritual enlightenment or nirvana or any of that. Yes, it's a suicide run. There is no return, no turning back. There will be nothing to come back to. If you're into the whole happily ever after thing, stay in orbit and think in terms of karma and dharma and countless lifetimes in which to follow the homeward trek. If you've had enough of that, then it's time to switch your attention away from all the spiritual gibberish and start thinking about breaking out of orbit for a suicide run. A significant part of your audience lives in California. It was almost painful to hear you say you hate L.A. and that part of the reason for that is probably Californians.
Yeah, I swing back to comment on that later in the book. I'm an East Coast guy, bad-mouthing the West Coast is all.
I lived in Montecito and further north for a time and liked it well enough. The East just seems more real to me. All I can think about when I'm in Southern California is getting out. But it's only a personal preference. I still have preferences, and I wanted to accentuate that apparent paradox. If there's ever a third book, there might not be too much in the way of my personal preferences, or the few that are left might come out very strongly and specifically. To me, Southern California feels like the mecca of ego. A strong distaste for ego is really the last of my strongly held preferences, and it's not likely to disappear. This is the ongoing minimalization of self I talked about in Damnedest. I'm kind of chronicling the second decade of the awakened being as I live it. I can forecast trends, but then I have to live them, too. I said I'd become less tolerant, and I am. The tattered remnants of self hang loosely from me. I almost have to clutch at them to have any presence at all. You make it sound like the awakening process continues even now. In a way, the awakening part was a very distinct event, like a nuclear explosion, and it occurred for me many years ago. The post-awakening process taking place since then is like the protracted effects of radiation poisoning. Your nose doesn't fall off in the first instant. It stays on for a while. You know it's not going to stay on for long, so you enjoy it while you can. You know what's coming. You know it's inevitable. You don't fear it or seek to avoid it. On the other hand, you're fond of your nose. I have a fondness for my nose, so maybe I staple it on or use a little duct tape so I can keep it a little longer. I'm not making an argument for this or defending a position. I'm just sharing my observations of the process. The awakening is complete, perfect, and irreversible. But no outer representation can reflect the inner state. At any moment since the point of awakening, I can, and have, shaken myself like a wet dog to cast off all the rags of self, the tatters of costume. So you can throw off self and put it back on? Such as it is, it's an advanced state of decay, and I can't stop or reverse that, but I can try to squeeze some further use out of what remains. I suppose I'll be able to fake my own personhood for as long as I live. but the veneer is getting pretty thin. It's only in interacting with people, with ego, that this is a problem? Yes. I have no other reason to slip into character. It's not really much of a problem, though. Not interacting with people is no great hardship for me. And it's not theoretical, right? You're not speculating. You're describing your actual experience? Yes. My experience is that of a non-egoic being who can wrap himself in a threadbare ego when necessary. And you don't see the paradox? The whole selfless self thing? I'll address this by saying that the enlightened state is not, as is commonly supposed, the special state. The unenlightened state is the magical, mysterious, incomprehensible state. Awake is just awake. It's not something more. It's everything less. My state is natural and easy. I carry no baggage. I labor under no delusion. I don't spend my life force animating a fictional persona. All paradox lies with the unawakened state. The awakened don't have something that the unawakened are missing. It's the other way around. The unawakened possess massive structures of false belief. They create and maintain these vast realms of past, present, and future, of great meaning and importance, of a deep and wide emotional range, all woven together out of sheer nothingness. Something from nothing. That's the magic. That's the special state. The unawakened state is the one that requires such ceaseless dedication and devotion, and which seems so fantastically improbable. The awakened state is nothing compared to that. That doesn't sound so good. I never said it was. Are you saying it's not? No. The life force I'm not using to project a false self is now available for much more fun and interesting purposes. It's a whole different universe once all that petty self-crap has been left behind. So, back to the first unsettling chapters. Unsettling is the right way to think of it. That probably reflects the higher intention at work. I look at those first few chapters like an establishing shot in film, providing the viewer with an overview of where events are taking place. The first chapter, Loomings, which is the title of the first chapter in Moby Dick, is like striking a gong to wake everyone up and let them know that the show has started and that it's a little weird, that something different is going on. Then the two California chapters continue this sort of destabilizing weirdness. The single question underlying the California chapters is stated in Chapter 2. Sure, you all meditate and do whatever spiritual practices, but you know that's not really going anywhere, right? That's an unsettling question. Anyone reading the book should be taken up short by that. Put themselves at that dinner table and look at their own Operation Fizzle and ask themselves serious questions about what they're really doing with all this spirituality stuff. So you were intentionally offensive? Part of the intent might have been to start out with a challenge. Suicide, Nazis, cat shit, teen angst. Is it funny or offensive? Good-spirited or mean? Is Jed arrogant or something else? Do I like him? What does it mean if I don't? Upon whom would that really reflect? Can an enlightened person behave this way? Right. Can this guy be enlightened if he acts this way, talks this way, sticks this semi-belligerent stuff in the front of his book? Where's the unconditional love? Where's the compassionate heart? Or wait, maybe it's my preconceived notions about spirituality and enlightenment that are screwy. Maybe I have to go back and think about what it would really be like to be an enlightened person in an unenlightened world. Maybe I've been sold a bill of goods. Maybe it's the sweetness and light version that doesn't make sense. And yet, in the second book, I would hope that the reader has read the first book and has some theoretical idea of what enlightenment, truth realization, abiding non-dual awareness, really means. The second book seems like more fun to me if you approach it from the perspective of having granted that Jed McKenna is an awakened being. We've already established that in the first book, so that should free us up to explore, to see what it's all about, what it's like to be in this state, to ask better questions, not, is this guy enlightened, but what does it mean that an enlightened being acts this way? What am I being shown about the awakened state? I don't want to make this all sound too carefully thought out, because the books really fall into place on their own. This is just my interpretation for how it is and my reasons for not changing it. You're interpreting your own book just like a reader would? Something like that. Those were the first three chapters since the first draft, and they never moved. I looked at them many times, wondering if it wasn't a bit much, and finally realized that in a book called Spiritually Incorrect Enlightenment, a bit much was probably about right. Also, I trust the thing that put them there more than I trust the thing in me that wanted to change them. And really, why not put it right up front? The book is called Spiritually Incorrect Enlightenment. But what does that mean? It means that getting there and being there isn't what you've been told. You look at modern spirituality, and all you see is the same tired drivel being endlessly recycled. Love, compassion, no mind, higher self, levels of consciousness, and so on. A noxious muck in which, as is amply borne out by results, no clarity or progress is possible. There is no greater failure in the history of mankind than the spiritual quest, the search for truth. And yet, everyone continues just as everyone always has, using the same maps and directions, the same guides and the same routes. It's nuts. Sooner or later, you have to come to the point of saying, hey, wait a minute. This is crazy. I want to get off this merry-go-round and get moving. How do I break free from this cycle of bumper sticker platitudes and actually take some responsibility for my life? If you're reading books by Jed McKenna, that's what you're playing at the edge of, self-determination. Not because it's of any importance, or to please anyone, or to line up a cozy afterlife. It's simply because it's honest. Ultimately, that's all we're talking about, living an honest life, being honest. So what's the solution? How do we break free? Look at Hercules in the Aegean stables. He could have picked up a shovel and spent his entire life shoveling shit, never making any progress because they're always making it faster than anyone can shovel it. What does he do instead? He reroutes a river so it flows through the stables, and with this one act, all the muck is washed away once and for all. That's the solution. Don't try to do battle with confusion and mediocrity. The solution to a problem does not exist at the level of the problem. Rise above the level at which confusion and mediocrity exist. Think for yourself. Look for yourself. See the big picture. Life is a one-man show. Turn up the house lights and see for yourself, directly, without the obstruction and distorting filters of interpreters or middlemen. What could be simpler? You're saying that people should... I have no opinion about what anyone should or shouldn't do. Some people like the smell of manure. In the context of this discussion, most people do. It's warm and familiar and safe. When it starts smelling like shit, like stagnation and death, like a dark, fetid dungeon, then you start wanting to do something to get away from it. When that happens, then you're starting to leave all the swami wannabes behind and represent your own interests. At that point, I can provide some simple guidance. Open your eyes. Look. See why it smells so bad. Nourish your discontent. Cultivate negative self-esteem. Elevate self-loathing to a spiritual practice. Proceed on the hypothesis that everything you are is a lie, and everything you know is wrong, and try to disprove it. Do you think there'll be a third book? Maybe. I seem to enjoy the writing, so I guess I'm not done with it. There are several things in the works. Maybe something will actually materialize. Do you think there might be more surprises, like with Moby Dick? I don't know. I certainly didn't see the white whale coming until it was right on top of me. Besides the revelations about Moby Dick, the other very surprising thing about SIE is that you steer readers away from enlightenment and toward the state you call human adulthood. Human adulthood is the real prize. Anyone who is involved in spiritual pursuits is actually pursuing human adulthood, but probably doesn't know it. The point I wanted to make is that human adulthood is what everyone really wants, and not many people really have. The child has to die for the adult to be born, and this very seldom happens. It's a cataclysmic death-rebirth event. Once born into this adulthood, all of life becomes about growth and delivery. The universe is the playground of the human adult. So, anyway, that was a major theme and incorrect because that's what it's really all about. Religion and spirituality are all about not going anywhere. Enlightenment is all about going and never stopping. Human adulthood is all about wandering and exploring and playing. It's about living life and fulfilling potential and expanding without limits. All the good things that can be said about enlightenment and religion and spirituality are the natural qualities of human adulthood. Manifestation of desires, flow, and effortless functioning. Positive emotions that are not fear-based, such as awe and gratitude and agape, which reflects an understanding of the connectedness of things. This is obviously what everyone really wants, not truth realization. So that's what I tried to talk about. You must have an intense sense of satisfaction at having created such superb books. But the real reason I bring it up is that I suspect you don't. You're right. I don't. I don't have that sort of relationship to the books. No sense of pride or ownership. No self-congratulatory feelings of accomplishment. In trying to answer this question, I'm struggling just to think of what type of feeling or attachment an author might have for his works. In any event, the books are fine. That's all. I was designed to write them, and I did. They're adequate. I am satisfied that I've done well, and there's nothing more to it. I have played my part adequately. Adequately. Meaning that you could have done better? Meaning I could have done worse. I've been pretty good about allowing the process to work. The books are as they should be. Are you totally beyond compliment or insult? I don't know about beyond. That might be misleading. I no longer possess the aspect of self that can be praised or insulted. There's no place for death to enter, that kind of thing. I don't think of myself as a writer or teacher or anything else. I just did what was indicated. If it remains indicated, I'll do it some more. If not, I won't. I really wouldn't mind just being done with the whole spirituality thing. It bears repeating that I'm not a spiritual person. If it weren't for the writing, I'd have no further connection to it at all. It's strange to think of a spiritual master, teacher, and author as being unspiritual or aspiritual. It must be strange for you to write for this audience. Sure. Now extend that a bit and imagine my situation in trying to continue to perform this communicator role. The fact is that I have almost no memory of the pre-awakened state. This isn't a fuzzy, feeling-level sort of thing. It's a quite specific and pronounced gap between my paradigm and the unawakened paradigm. And it keeps getting wider as my memories of my own life in the other paradigm fade. This must be very challenging. Only where ego is concerned. It wouldn't matter to me at all except for the writing. To write books, I have to speak across that chasm, and it's getting impossibly wide. So it makes writing the books a challenge because empathy is nearly gone. I have practically no memory of what it means to believe anything. Most people reading this would probably see someone who believes in televangelist faith healers and supermarket tabloids the same way that I see everyone. From my perspective, all beliefs are nonsensical. I can no longer draw any real distinction between the merits of one and another. They're all equal because they're all untrue. People reading this probably look at people who send their retirement money to TV preachers and wonder how they can be so gullible. But from my perspective, everyone is that gullible. I no longer see any difference between any two people's beliefs. I no longer can. There is no better or worse belief, no more or less true. They're all dream state apparitions that have no reality or solidity outside of the dream. I can make out no distinction other than that. And yet, I seem to have this task of trying to communicate across this ever-widening divide, to connect with minds that don't see this gulf or really believe it's there. That's the thing that's happening. The gulf is getting wider. The idea that the Holy Roman Church is somehow better or truer or more valid than a suicide cult is lost on me. I'm no longer capable of perceiving or pretending to perceive such distinctions. I know that one has more adherence than the other, but that doesn't mean anything. From my perspective, a person is either in the process of waking up or they're not. That's the only distinction I see clearly anymore. One is either confronting reality or denying it. A lot of people who have met you through the books are eager to meet you in person. We've seen some pretty interesting offers of what people would give or do to be with you, even for a short while. That's not indicated.
You sound like a robot at times.
Even to myself. But the fact remains that I am designed to do what I've done. Right. But I am not designed to fulfill a public role.
Designed?
Designed. Destined. Dharmically inclined. Whatever. I enjoy writing, but I don't enjoy people. Which is to say, ego. This aversion to ego seems perfectly normal to me. I don't think it's at all strange, so it's not likely to change. In fact, I'd encourage everyone to develop a similar aversion. There's only one false, petty, fearful, dishonest thing in the universe, and it's ego, the false self. I think anyone who really comes to know it will come to be repulsed by it, and that's certainly moving in the direction of waking up. In any case, I'm a private person, and I have nothing to say that isn't in the books. I made that point in this book. There's simply not that much to say, and I've said it all. I can continue to write, to expand on themes, go deeper into some topics, but that's about it. Anyone who wants to track me down, ask me questions, benefit from whatever they think I can offer, is operating purely from denial. It's easy to convince yourself otherwise, that seeking out a direct relationship with some whoop-de-doo spiritual fella is the mark of deep commitment. But it's Maya who's doing the convincing. What would I possibly have to say to someone? We've already determined, to a reasonable certainty, that there are no valid questions left unanswered by the books. So what would I do? Cite page numbers? If someone comes up to me now, seeking whatever, all I could tell them is, Maya sent you. It's her hand up your ass, turning your head, moving your lips. You have serious work to do, and the only reason you came here was to avoid it. If people don't want to be serious about this, they don't have to be. That's entirely their business. But from the very outset of this publishing project, I was determined that I would not allow myself to be drawn into people's avoidance games. Everyone wants to talk about it, but there's nothing to say. It's easy to take a trip, pay some money, give up some comforts, prostrate yourself at someone's feet, obey, adore, exalt, whatever, and think that translates into something positive, some sort of forward motion. But these are all the acts of an ego seeking to divert attention away from the real issue with busy work and empty gestures, false acts of surrender, allowing us to convince ourselves that we're striding boldly into the light while staying safely huddled in shadow. No one needs me for that. Anyone with a genuine desire to face the issue of self already has all I can offer. Use the process of spiritual autolysis and try to figure out what's true. Everything else is about being turned away. You make it sound so simple, but in reality it's the most difficult thing anyone can ever do.
Well, there's the critical point. It's not a matter of awakening. It's a matter of getting to the first step. Once you've taken the first step, everything else follows from there. Until you've taken the first step, it's all academic. The first step is the true starting point of this whole process. Everything else is about taking or not taking the first step. To get to the first step, to cross that starting line, you have to cultivate an understanding and appreciation of the forces you're up against, of Maya, of ego, of the nature of self-delusion, of fear, or else no amount of dedication or commitment will avail in the least. If you're all mind and no heart, you can only run in circles. If you're all heart and no mind, you can only dig yourself into a deeper hole. Until you cross the real starting line, take the first step. It's all just a hobby, like golf or stamp collecting. Spirituality itself is just another tool of denial, the most effective of them all. And that's why the search for truth is the greatest failure in the history of man. Here's a simple test. If it's soothing or comforting, if it makes you feel warm and fuzzy, if it's about getting into pleasant emotional or mental states, if it's about peace, love, tranquility, silence, or bliss, if it's about a brighter future or a better tomorrow, if it makes you feel good about yourself or boosts your self-esteem, tells you you're okay, tells you everything's just fine the way it is, if it offers to improve, benefit, or elevate you, or if it suggests that someone else is better or above you, if it's about belief or faith or worship, if it raises or alters consciousness, if it combats stress or deepens relaxation, or if it's therapeutic or healing, or if it promises happiness or relief from unhappiness, if it's about any of these or similar things, then it's not about waking up. Then it's about living in the dream state, not smashing out of it. On the other hand, if it feels like you're being skinned alive, if it feels like a prolonged evisceration, if you feel your identity unraveling, if it twists you up physically and drains your health and derails your life, if you feel love dying inside you, if it seems like death would be better, then it's probably the process of awakening.